it. And then in order for me to get in shape, Lopez then decided that I should go to San Diego. Went to San Diego, and I was there for about 2 weeks before I started playing. And I hit a triple in Sacramento. And I slid into third base and dislocated my left hand. And came to Baltimore, John Hopkins operated on, put a pin in, and I had a new cast for quite a while, and then I started exercising. And they decided for me to go to Toronto and to work out, to work myself back into shape. And I was in Toronto for maybe 2 weeks. Never played a game, but I worked out a lot. Never played. But my hamstring bothered me, so that I went, they sent me back to the hospital. And they had to take the pin out because the pin was deteriorating the bone. Cut it again, put the pin out, put it in a cast again. And the rest of the year I was in the cast, and I took it off, worked out, exercised, went to spring training in 60, but didn't have no mobility or anything. So that was it. I decided that was it.
You packed it in at that time.
Yeah.
What did you immediately do then after retirement?
Came out of it.
I know you ended up in
scouted,
Japan.
I scouted with for Bill for 61 and 62. I went to Japan.
Right. How did that happen?
Don Newcomb, who's a good friend of mine, got a call from a friend of his in Japan that was looking for a couple of American ball players. So he called me and asked me would I be interested. Sure. So I went with him to a town called Nagoya. Tanishi Jack, and I played there 1 year.
1 year, okay.
And I came back home, opened up a business in New York, stayed in the business for about 3 years, and Don McHale, who got the franchise in Montreal, I wrote him a letter and asked him if I'd like to be a part of it. He hired me in 68. In 69, I worked in the minor leagues as hitting instructor. In 70, I became coach of Montreal.
Tell me a little bit about Japan, though. How was your stay there?
I enjoyed Japan. They treated us well. We had got a house for us. We had two people working with. One spoke English in Japan, and one spoke only Japanese. And we had an interpreter that was with us all the time. Took us to eat, took us around the town. And we met the prime minister. Went to different places like where the sumo wrestlers trained, and went to the beast Nagoya, the beast city. And all, you know, we had a nice time. They treated us fine. The only place that, and I can understand, I think all Americans can understand it to a certain degree, was Hiroshima. No one was very. They never bothered you, never said it, but just never. Never became real friendly. Sort of standoffish like.
Why was it just one season? Was there any particular reason it was only one season in Japan?
Well, because the next season they asked me to come back, and I think the money came. We couldn't get the money. I asked for that $1,000.
How many Americans were playing over there at that time?
There was only about, if I'm correct, and I hope I am, maybe five.
Was Don Newcomb playing at the time?
Yeah, but we were the only major leaguers. The other guys were the minor.
Okay, they were Americans, but not major leaguers. So
no.
Just you and Don Newcomb were the only two major leaguers.
I think we were probably the first major.
You were the first two, yeah.
Okay.
All right, so then you started coaching at Montreal in 70, and I know you coached a few years.
Yeah.
Hitting instructor, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I know that you eventually managed the White Sox for a period of time in 78.
Got a time.
Tell me how that happened, and...
he had always said to me that if the opportunity arises, he would give me an opportunity to manage. And we had a pretty good ball club in 77. We were in the running for up until about 2 weeks. You can't see, it got hot and won like 14 out of 16 or something like that. And we finally won the thing. in 78, we lost Oscar Gamble, we lost Jesse Zisk, we lost quite a number of good players, and we were having a tough time winning. And Lem was, Bob Lem was manager. And then one day, Brett called me and said, I'd like you to take over the ball club, because Bob was going to leave, and I said, okay. And we played, we didn't play too well the first, maybe the first 3 or 4 weeks, first month. And then we got hot, and we played over 500 balls for the next 2.5 months. But then at the end of the year, we decided to make another change. Basically, I think change came about because I think we're looking to put some more seats in the ballpark than Kessinger, who had been a favorite in Chicago because he played for the Cubs. Of course, he played shortstop for the White Sox at the time. I think from putting more people in the ballpark, because Kessinger would do better than I did. So.
Where did you go from there then? Did you stay?
I just coached. He
was just back as coach. Did it bother you that you were not still a manager? Did you want to be?
Yeah, it bothered me too. For one reason, I didn't think that I had enough time to really find out whether I could have.
Right, you had less than this one season.
Yeah, so I didn't know whether I could have, but not. I saw some improvement that had come about when I got the opportunity to manage those 2.5, 3, 4 months. But then there were other things that I wasn't sure about. The other thing is you win games or you're successful as a winning manager, coach, whatever, depending on the personnel.
Absolutely.
And there's nobody that smart, in my opinion, that can have a less quality player and be successful as a winner. You've got to have quality players. And of course, those quality players have to be productive, consistent. It can't be 2 or 3 days and then 5 or 6 days. No, the consistency has to be in that. So we didn't have those kind of players at that particular time, unfortunately. So my thing was that I had known Bill for so long, and I'd always thought that he would certainly be honest with me in terms of why I was hired, number one, and why I was fired. I understood why I was hired, but I didn't understand why I was fired. And he said to me, I can never really tell you, because I think if I did, you and I would both sit here and cry. So I said, well, okay, that's good enough. But I had a pretty good idea. I had a pretty good idea.
You think because of Kessinger, is that what you think?
Kessinger,
something else?
Kessinger, plus I didn't think that the majority of the owners got the backing. I got the backing from the majority of the owners. I think that my backing really came from the back. I don't think the majority of the owners.
Frank Robinson was in Cleveland by now.
Frank had been, I was.
You were the second.
Yeah, but I was coaching Cleveland when Frank came here.
Okay.
So I was going to Cleveland 74.
Right.
Because there was supposed to be an opportunity over there for the manager's thing. And then Frank came in. And then I went back to Montreal in 70, 75, 76. And then I went to Chicago in 77.
Right.
Okay.
So after that short managerial stint, you continued to coach, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then how did that come to an end? I know you didn't coach forever.
I went to spring training in 79, and I was sort of put on the back burner. In other words, I was a hidden coach. But during spring, if I didn't go with the big club to different exhibition games, I would stay back in Sarasota and work with some of the hitters. So I just felt that, the person that runs the ball club, he makes the rules. But I just felt that being put on the back burner was my, I didn't, that wasn't the thing I wanted. what I did in 79 was I'd go to the minor leagues and do some hitting, obviously teach some hitting, and roam around when the team was going to go, come to Chicago when the team was going to work with some hitting, and go back on the minor leagues and do the same thing. And then it's the end of 79, I retired. Yeah, and I joined the New Jersey Nets as community director.
Right, so you spent some time with the Nets doing that kind of thing.
I spent my next 10 years.
Okay, we'll get to what you're doing right now in a minute. I wanted to ask you about a couple of people you played with and people you associated with.
Okay.
The guy you mentioned before is Bill Veeck. Tell me what kind of a guy Bill Veeck was.
Probably one of the best down-to-earth human beings I've ever met. Didn't play games. Didn't throw rhetoric around. Dealt with the truth, the facts, obeyed the law. If I lost my father when I was 8 years old, if my father ever lived, I would have backed him.
It's quite a compliment.
You're not going to find a lot of people say that about me.
Well, this is
But I'm saying that because I knew the man. I first met the man in 47, and I knew him before he passed away, and I couldn't possibly with him and around him and listening to him, talking with him. He was quite a man. I don't think he'd ever get accolades that he should get.
Well, how did you feel when he was put in the Hall of Fame? Did you feel
good
about
great,
that?
But I felt that there was a lacking because Bart didn't get done before he passed away. You know,
that's it.
But that's the way some people operate. That's where the politics are and whatever.
Okay, your first manager in Cleveland was Lou Boudreau.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about him.
Nice man. You know.
A good ball player, right?
Yeah.
MVP in 48.
Good ball player. Knew the political arena real well. You know, and worked with the political arena real well. I can't say that we were real close or we were real friendly. I mean, he's a manager of ball club, manager of 25 players. I didn't expect him to be close to me. There was a fellow by the name of Bill McKechnie who was real, real close, who helped me a lot during those first 4 or 5 years. Him and of course Joe Gordon. But McKechnie was kind of a man that would say to me, hey, so and so and so, this is where you should, this is what you should do. I never forget one in St. Louis. The gentleman in the stand was making remarks about my wife. And I sort of lost my bearing. When I started up in the stand, he grabbed me, put me back, and sit me down and said, well, remember that. These are the things that's going to happen that you can't do. I think if you worked for that, I'd probably been in the stand. Probably never be sitting here talking to him.
You mentioned Joe Gordon, real
good
ball
people.
Player.
Good,
and
good
tell me about Joe.
Real, real good people. One of those good people. I'll never forget, on my first day in Chicago, you know, you time to warm up. So I walked out on the field, and I must have been there for about five, seemed like a year, but about 5 or 10 minutes, waiting when all of a sudden it came out. You warmed up with the rest of the year.
You mentioned Bob Lemon before. You said you got along good with Bob Lemon,
Bob,
right?
Bob was good. Jim Deacon was good. This is my first year. And then later on, early with was good.
Right.
There was a lot of guys, you know, the younger guys were very good guys. But in the beginning, you're talking about first week in baseball. And you're talking about Gordon, you're talking about McKechnie, and you're talking about Lemon, and you're talking about Beegan. They were nice.
Bob Lemon was a great pitcher. He was a good hitter, too.
Yeah.
He has the impression of being an easygoing type of fellow. Is that how
you face it? Yeah, Bob doesn't. You know, play the game of baseball, play it hard, and have a good time. Yeah.
Okay, I know you played with Bob Feller, too. He was probably one of the older players.
Yeah, Bob was, well, you know, when you grow on a baseball team, during the time I went on that team in 47, there are people who hang out with each other.
Right, so.
You know, and of course, I'm never in a hotel with them, so,
right.
You know, I never became real friendly with them.
And you mentioned early Wynn, was he, we hear a lot of stories about how he was kind of mean out on the mound.
Yeah,
is that all true?
Well, that's one thing about him. When I don't care, the day he's pitching, you don't have to worry about knockdown. Because nobody's going to knock you down. Because you knock me down or somebody on my team down, he'd knock down the whole nine people that came to bat. So, you know, he was that kind of competitive. Plus, he was a good person.
You played with Al Rosen, too, in 54.
Yeah.
He had a couple of really good years for the Indians.
Yeah, had good years with us. Good third base, played well.
Remember anything about Al? I know you probably didn't get to know some of these guys too well because you were not with them a lot, right?
No.
In Chicago, you ended up playing with Minnie Minoso.
Yeah, well, Minnie was with us in Cleveland.
Right, and
he
got Cleveland, right.
Yeah.
So tell me about Minnie. And you knew him from the Negro Leagues too, right?
Yeah.
Tell me about
good hustler, good player, hard player, played hard, loved the game. And just an all-around good person.
He's still trying to play to this
day.
Yeah,
well, he'll always try to play. As long as he lives, he'll try to play.
Okay, I know you play with Nellie Fox, too, right?
Nellie was a good player and a good person. Jim Lalo was a good player, good person.
And you played with Louis Aparicio, too.
Aparicio was a good player.
Now, I know that you also played for a period of time with Satchel Paige in Cleveland, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, 48. Satchel came with us in September.
Right.
But I had played against him.
But you knew him from before. Tell me if you could about Satchel Paige.
Any stories that you hear about him, as far as his ability was,
throw really hard, right?
Was that good. Now, we played the 1946 Super Bowl World Series against Kansas City. We beat him 2 games, 2-1, both games, but he was good.
Was he, there are a lot of stories about him, like folklore almost. Is that the type of guy he was? I mean, he seemed to have a lot of catchy phrases.
Yeah, happy-go-lucky person. Nothing bothered him. Baseball was his main thing. And very jovial type person. Funny type person. Somewhat of a self-made comedian, you know. But good people.
Yeah.
Good people.
All right, now you played for Lou Boudreau and Al Lopez.
Yep.
How would you compare those two? Both Hall of Famers.
Well, you know, we go back to the personality in terms of.
Well, tell me about Al Lopez then. We talked about Lou Boudreau.
He had good ball clubs, you know, when he won those pennants. You know, you're talking about Rose.
Right.
And Strickland played great shortstop. You know, Mila playing second base. And of course, we had a fellow right here from Jersey named Glenn. That was the first base. Easter was it before. But Easter got sent down the line. And then he had Al Smith and had Egan playing. Then he got those four pitchers. He got Garcia, Wynn, and Fellow,
Lemon.
You know,
right.
He had good players. Boudreau had good players on the team.
How would you compare them as managers? Would you say that Al Lopez?
They both similar. Just let you play.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't crowd you with a lot of fundamentals as far as basic fundamentals of the game. You would have to do cheat. They would teach you that, and you'd have to do this over consistently until you got it done right. And then they would never put you in a position. I can't recall them putting most players in position who, when you needed execution, couldn't do it, so they wouldn't put you in that position. But they were the first thing I think both of them had was being able to deal with the personnel. And you know yourself that you've got 25 players, for those 25 personnel. And then you can blend all those personnel together and know just what to do and how to do it, what makes one move, what doesn't make one move.
You said your closest friends on the team were the guys you said before, Joe Gordon, McKeegan, a couple of the other guys you mentioned. When you were growing up in Patterson, and did you follow did you have a favorite player or a team, or you just played and you really weren't a fan in most?
Most of the people that I followed, most of the people as a kid I thought I would like to be like, one was a kid that played in I went to in Carolina, they were Gibson Bowls. We played football, baseball, basketball. We were real good, and I wanted to be like them. And then when I moved to Patterson, when we started high school, we had a kid by the name of Bob Smith. He was a great athlete, and I wanted to be like him. But when you talk about baseball, I know there was no one because there were no black players. So I could see myself saying, well, I'm Joe DiMaggio, or I'm Joe Gordon, or I want to be like him. It just wasn't the thing. Football-wise, I saw players in college. We had a guy by the name of Ozzie Simmons. He went to the University of Iowa. I used to see most of the while. Listen to most of the while on the radio. Bill Stern would do Ohio State game against Iowa. And he was a tremendous football player. Matter of fact, when I was in high school, we had a semi-pro football team in Patterson called the Patterson Panthers. So I used to usher. And after he got out of college, he came there as a player.
Okay. After you finished your work for the Nets, you now.
Well, what happened was Mr. Giamatti became the Christian, and I had been working for the Nets for like almost 10 years. There was a fellow by the name of Joe Cobb who went to my high school. He became created ADP, data processing, and he bought the Virginia Nets, and he asked me if I'd be interested in the community director. And that was the time when I went back to Chicago, and I was doing the minor leagues, and I decided, well, I'll take this opportunity. So I took that opportunity to go to the Nets, and Mr. Giamatti became the commissioner of baseball. Found out that I was thought that with the history I had brought to baseball, that I should be in baseball. So he called me up and I talked to him. Put together a program where we represented about 500% of players. I am a licensed administrator for this project. It's a good feeling because you look at a lot of the players that are involved in the program. I played with or I played against or played during the time that I was playing. And of course a lot of them now that are in the program have played much lately, you know, in the last 10 years, 5 years, so you can when you can send out a check, I don't care if it's only $100 to those kind of players, it makes you feel good because they never made the big money.
Right.
You know, if you go back in the era of my particular era, you're talking about $5 minimum, and if you made 25 or 30, you make a big money. So these guys, who a lot of them are still alive, still have kids and all that stuff, they just send them an extra buck. And I enjoy it. I enjoy the job, number one, because I work with some good people. And I enjoy being able to get a phone call from the player or get a note from the player saying thank you.
Okay. What's your opinion of baseball today? Do you follow it?
Baseball is a great game.
Well,
you know, my opinion of baseball is that baseball is always going to be baseball. Baseball will survive whatever the crisis might be because it involves people. And it involves people with knowledge. It involves people with knowing that we've got to, whatever the price, whatever the situation may be, whatever the negative may be, in order to make that negative positive, we've got to work together as people. Now, there's no question people talk about the numbers in terms of dollars that are going to players. Well, it just so happened that these are the times. This is what it's all about. And if this game is destroyed, then you would have to blame players and people who are involved in the game. But I don't think so. I just think that people are smart enough to understand the fact that this is an all-American game. People, a lot of people out there watch this game. And for the good of the people, and for the good of the players, and the good of the owner of the ball, whatever the problems are, let's get together and work them out. And I don't care what anybody says. People, they're working on it. Whatever the situation might be, whatever the reason for the negative, they're working on it.
The new playoff format, now I guess you've heard about that.
Yeah.
What's your opinion of that kind of thing?
Puts extra money in people's pockets. It's hard for me to grasp that idea because I come from the old school.
Right.
I come from a thing where you play 154 games, and the person that's at the top, at the end of that 154 games, he plays the person at the top in the other league. So it's hard for me to digest what we're seeing now. I'm going to have to see it. I'm going to have to look at it, and I'm going to have to judge it from a standpoint of what is in the future? What will happen in the future? Are we going to do something else to change this? You know, and I don't think baseball is the kind of thing you can change a lot. You can't fool tackle with baseball too much because you know it's basic run, throw, hit, field, and that sort of stuff. Now even with the number of teams we got, the one thing it has done, it has given more jobs, but you still have diluted the quality. Because we're dealing with something that I don't think too many people think about. We're dealing with education, one. We're dealing with basketball and football, which is much, much popular, more popular now than it was in the 50s and the 40s. But the most important thing you're dealing with, in my opinion, is education. Because now when you got kids that play baseball, basketball, football, okay, now here comes a college coach. Going into a rich neighborhood or going into a poor neighborhood and saying, well, give himself a career, scholarship, education, football, scholarship, basketball. Now that same kid plays baseball, but it's not the baseball scholarship, but it's the football and the basketball scholarship. So we got a lot of that going on, and we lose a lot of good players. If Bo Jackson had come up in my area, he'd never play football. Santa would never play football. Because the moment that he got out of high school and having the ability that he had, he'd have been put into a minor league because he couldn't afford to go to college. See, so now you're dealing with that. And like the kid in North Carolina, that Taylor at the Yankees son, well, he left college, he was going to get a scholarship for college, but once you say $1.5 million, well, but how many kids can you afford to give $1.5 million before they even pitch a ball, a double A ball, a triple? How many kids can you give that kind of money? Doing our area, you didn't have to because once you reach high school, you can't go to college. I mean, if you went to college, I had a scholarship, but how many kids that could get scholarships at that time? Not that many. So your mother and father, a job. So the best job in the world is to be able to play baseball and go to mileage and earn X number of dollars, doing something that you like to do, and you don't look at it as work.
Okay, you had some ups and downs in your career, I guess. Well, you seem to have turned your negatives into positives. Any other thought or anything else that you'd like to just close with? Because
well,
I don't have anything else to ask you.
Okay, well, I think that what I like to, when I talk to kids, kind of let kids know the fact that, you know, people say, well, you can be whatever you want to be. And that's good. But you be what you want to be, which is what am I qualified to be? You just can't tell a kid you can be a baseball player, a football player, a basketball player if he doesn't have a certain amount of ability. But he certainly can be something else, because I think athletics are probably the toughest thing to do. And the second thing is that percentage from a baseball standpoint is very, very low in terms of those who make it. But you have to prepare yourself for something else because you do have more than one thing. God has given you a mind, and then when he gives you athletic ability, that's something extra. But we all have a mind, so we develop a mind in terms of what we're best doing. So my thing is that whatever you do, wherever you go, particularly from Afro-American standpoint, you're gonna be met with negatives. So you have to make sure that you know how to do the negative to make it positive. Because if you don't, then you're never gonna be successful. It's not gonna, when I walk into baseball, why did I have to go through all those things to be a baseball player? Why couldn't I be just like any other American that goes into the game and enjoy the game, the things that you, that the hotel is providing them? Because of the fact that it protects you of my skin. So now, if that had been a thing where I would not have been able to adjust to overcome, then I could have never been able to play the game of baseball, or wouldn't be here talking to you today. The last thing is this, that I never intend, and never will, use 1947, 48, 49, and 50 from a segregated standpoint to look for sympathy or to better myself. My point is that through experience, exposure, and maturity, I know what it is to have gone through those particular situations. I would like to be a part of this world, community, job, church, to let people know that we can live together as people if we decide to do it in terms of sit down and communicate. I joined that ball club, not too many guys, looked at me as an individual, baseball player, looked at me as a person. And I had a school for them. I either play or I can't play. You don't judge me until you screen here. Don't judge me until we sit and talk. You're gonna have some differences, I'm gonna have some differences. But you don't base it on the color of the skin of the person. The God above that put us all on earth, in my opinion, put us on earth with different nationalities and colors to see if we can get along. And prove that we can. But we can. As strong as we are, as big as we are, we can get together as people if we want to. But if you don't want to, then you're not going to do it. Now, one of the things that hurt, in my opinion now, is you got inner cities, you got suburban. A kid in suburban never see a kid in inner city. A kid in inner city never see a kid in suburban communicate well. The only time they see him on television. When they do meet, it's going to be strange. It's going to be very strange. But both kids understand. Who knows what he's been taught over here? Who knows what he's been taught over here? If they're not taught the same thing, then there's a difference. And my time, one of the other things that's good about my time, I grew up in a big country. The tough time that I walked in the Cleveland in 1920 wasn't so much the people who've never been around, or people from my nationality. That's the part of it. And if we don't, even in time, if we don't get together as people, work this thing out. Well,
okay, well, it was really great talking to you. Thank you.